Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 532. Interview with John Loftus about Unholy Trinity and Intelligence Summit. This has been recorded on November 6th of the year 2005. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves John Loftus, author of, among other titles, The Belarus Secret, The Secret War Against the Jews, and Unholy Trinity, the last two books co-authored with Mark Ahrens. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we are going to be talking about a new project of yours and a project that was both old and now is new again, so to speak, born again. Let's start with something you call Intelligence Summit. What is that? And can you tell people perhaps how they might participate in this?
Sure. It's the details are on our website, www.intelligencesummit.org. And essentially, we're a public charity of people from all walks of life with bipartisan, strictly neutral. And we're trying to help members of the international intelligence community get to know each other, get to listen and learn from each other. So once a year, we take over a hotel in Washington, D.C., and we invite members of the intelligence community, the media, and the public to just sit down and talk. Now, the rules are very strict. If you're a member of the media or a member of the public, you have to promise that you can quote what is said, but you can never quote who said it or from what agency. So we want to encourage the greatest degree of candor possible. And you'll have some of the top speakers in the world coming to the intelligence topic. This will be a chance to sit down with former heads of CIA, defense intelligence, British intelligence, the Mossad, and on and on and on. It's an amazing occasion for American citizens and people around the world who care about freedom to have that interesting battle in this age of terrorism between the need for civil rights and civil liberties and the need for security against the common enemy of terrorism. How do we do this? How do we do a better job?
So basically, this is not only an attempt to promote information sharing, file sharing, as it were, between members of the world's intelligence communities, both active and, quote, retired, unquote, because they maintain a certain relationship, but also to promote dialogue between members of the general public and some of these self-same individuals.
Yeah, it's particularly important, we think, for members of the media to really sit down and talk with members of the intelligence community. The two of them might as well be on different planets.
Yep.
And they have a lot to say to each other and a lot to learn from each other.
Yeah, and my own feeling is that people from the research community as well, because there's just an awful lot of corruption there. But that is in and of itself a long story. Now, your website is, John?
www.intelligencesummit.org.
Okay, so that's where people can find out about this project. Yeah. Alrighty, now this past spring, we're speaking now in November of 2005, there were several stories that hit the media all at, within about 4 or 5 days of one another. Of course, a new pope was elected by the cardinals, the first German pope in history, and right about that same time, there was a story that impinges directly on the Vatican where four alleged co-conspirators were indicted for the murder of former Vatican financial advisor and Propaganda Due Lodge member Roberto Calvi. His suicide/murder was one of the things that occasioned an investigation on the part of John Paul II into the scandal surrounding the Vatican Bank. And one of the guys he brought in was a fellow named Hermann Abs. Perhaps we can talk about him later. But right about the same time, there was a story that appeared in the media where a lawsuit against the Vatican Bank that had originally been thrown out by a lower U.S. court was reinstated. And, John, according to report, you are no stranger to that lawsuit.
Yeah, I'm on retainer as the intelligence advisor for the lawsuit. The lawsuit essentially represents people, Jews and non-Jews, who are victims of the Nazis in Eastern Europe, particularly in the Croatian area, where the Croatian Fascist Party stole their money and then laundered it out through the Vatican down to Argentina after World War II. So essentially, our clients are saying they were robbed, and they want their money back. And it's not just the robbers who are guilty. It's the corrupt people who hid the money and laundered it who also bear some responsibility. It's an interesting theory, and for the first time, the federal courts are agreeing with us that it's still a valid legal theory and that we have a right to sue.
Right, and one of the things about this, the lawsuit that you basically are acting as intelligence advisor to, has now been reinstated, and that is now in the courts once again, whereas it was dormant. It is now active, correct, John?
Yeah, we won a big victory in the Ninth Circuit, and John Levy is the attorney. He's doing a wonderful job on this. And it's coming along pretty well. The Vatican was rather shocked. They made a huge mistake at the outset of the case. When they read the lawsuit that we filed, someone marked it up and scribbled comments in the margins and then returned it. Well, that was proof that they had read it. And it was terribly important to assert jurisdiction over the Vatican because they couldn't deny that they had read the complaint and were familiar with its contents.
Now, the imbroglio surrounding the Vatican Bank and the looting of funds from Holocaust victims and a variety of other sordid activities was the focal point of a book that you co-authored again with Mark Ahrens called Unholy Trinity. We've spoken about some of your other books in the past, John, but not Unholy Trinity at all.
Well, Unholy Trinity essentially was the things that were censored out of my first book, The Ballara Secret.
Mm-hmm.
I was told when I submitted, because of that, I had all these very high security clearances, that my books would always have to undergo review by various different agencies, the pre-publication committees. And they said, no, we can't mention anything about the Vatican and their role in helping the Nazis, so that has to all be stricken out. That just annoyed me, so of course we went and found a legal way to get all this information into the public domain. Essentially, we had a very enterprising kid from Britain who spoke Serbo-Croatian fluently, and he posed as a young fascist and went around and interviewed all the surviving Croatian fascist priests and tape recorded them, and thinking that he was another young Nazi looking for the history of this wonderful thing that they had done. The priest blabbed into our tape recorder about how the Vatican smuggled all the Nazi money out and smuggled all the Nazis out, and it was devastating. I mean, the Vatican, in essence, blew the whistle on themselves, and we played the tapes back to various government agencies, and they said, all right, we can't censor you anymore. They've already exposed themselves, so we got permission to go ahead with the book.
Really? Fascinating. Fascinating. John, one of the things about Unholy Trinity is that reading that book, as is the case with the Secret War Against the Jews, and this is not a knock in any way, but an enthusiastic endorsement of same. It's sort of an encouragement to members of the audience to read the book, but it's a little like trying to drink from a fire hose. And if that's a tall order, I think trying to boil down that book to one interview here, or at least some of the key points, is perhaps even more daunting an enterprise. But what the heck? With that introduction, why don't we see what we can do? One of the things that's so interesting about the book, John, is the detailing of the history of Vatican financial dealings with the Nazis and with the fascists in general, something which, as you point out, has been oversimplified in the past for ideological reasons. Let's start with La Popessa and some of the disclosures that you relate concerning some goings-on right at the end of World War One.
Sure. When Pacelli, who later became Pope Pius XII, was serving in Germany after World War One, he was terrified of the communists. And his personal assistant was a nun and a faithful secretary. La Popessa was her nickname, the woman pope. She witnessed him handing over bags of cash from the Vatican to fund political activism, and he was handing it personally to Adolf Hitler. So, you know, in many ways, the infant Nazi party got a little help from the Roman Catholic Church. Now, they weren't doing anything much different than the American investors were doing. They thought that Hitler would be a nice dog in a leash to keep the trade unions and the communists at bay. And nobody really favored the Nazi party. There was a Catholic party of Germany that, quite frankly, the American investors were more comfortable with. Oddly enough, the Italian members of the Catholic Church didn't like the German Catholic Church, because the German Catholic Church was A, too wealthy, and B, too independent. And so, in essence, the Italian Catholics conspired with the early members of the Nazi party and other groups to undercut the power and influence of the German Catholic Church. So, sad to say, these early internecine rivalries in small ways contributed to the rise of Hitler.
And again, that was Papal Nuncio to Munich, Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli. Actually, I guess he was an archbishop at that point. Anyway, later the fellow who became better known as Pope Pius XII, and his assistant, Sister Pascalina Lehnert, also known as La Popessa, in a book by Paul Murphy of the same name. John, one of the things you point out in Unholy Trinity is how the Lateran Treaty led to a much larger relationship between German heavy industry and the Vatican. Particularly for the benefit of younger members of the audience, explain what the Lateran Treaty was, what it entailed, and in turn detail for us how that led to the Vatican's financial relationship with German heavy industry.
Okay, about 300 years ago, Napoleon invaded Italy. And it was a traumatic effect for the Roman Catholic Church. And they, in essence, retreated behind the walls of the Vatican City State. There were Vatican ground, papal states, parts of provinces of Italy that were owned by the Catholic Church. This guy was pretty much anti-modernity, anti-democracy, anti-anything that Napoleon was for, they were against. And what happened is that over the 300 years, they stacked the votes for Pope so that only Italian cardinals could be elected Pope. They rigged the books. And as a result, the Italian Catholic Church became ultra, ultra conservative. Now, one of the major points of friction they had in Italy was who owns the land. The church said, well, we own part of Italy. And the new Italian secular government said, no, we're going to run the country. Thank you very much. And they eventually worked out a compromise where the church would be reimbursed for the loss, the monetary loss of the papal lands. And in return, the headquarters of the Catholic Church in Rome would be recognized as a separate state, a sovereign nation, as it were. And when the Pope wears three crowns, one of the crowns is the king of the state. And the Vatican City State is, in fact, to this day, a sovereign nation. The Lateran Treaty was the means by which those diplomatic negotiations were put into force. It was between the Italian government and the Vatican State.
And now, ultimately, the Vatican got a lot of money from this. And that, in turn, as you mentioned, was invested in German heavy industry.
Yeah, well, there were a lot of American investors at the time, and they're telling the Vatican the real smart way to put their money would be to put it in Germany. As Germany, after World War I, seemed like a weird place to invest because it was bankrupt, it was destitute. It would take, you know, a wheelbarrow full of marks in order to be able to purchase a loaf of bread. But precisely because the currency was so bad, that meant that foreign investors who had access to gold could buy up German corporations at a song, and that's what the Americans were doing. Part of the reason for the huge amount of American investment, which the Vatican piggybacked on with the proceeds from the Lateran Treaty, was that the Teddy Roosevelt and both Republicans and Democrats passed anti-monopoly laws, anti-cartel legislation, trust-busting, and this made it very difficult for the money brokers of Wall Street. Their nickname was the robber barons. Well, they really couldn't rob very well anymore in America because it was now against the law. So what these guys did is they exported their monopolies overseas. And they did that by passing a little-known law. The Webb-Pomeroy Act of 1918 was the ultimate loophole law. It says you can't have monopolies and trusts and cartels in America, but you can build them overseas. And so the giant sucking sound was all the American investment capital whistling out of Wall Street into Germany and France and buying up corporate stock. The Vatican just followed along with this trend. In fact, one of the reasons for the Great Depression was so much of the investment capital left the United States in a flood and poured into companies. Now, for example, the ThyssenKrupp Corporation is the wealthiest conglomerate in Europe, and it's secretly owned in substantial part through the Chase Manhattan Bank and through the Vatican.
And points that you make, or one of the relationships that you trace for a period of decades in Unholy Trinity, is the relationship between Sullivan and Cromwell, an institution called the BIS, or the Bank for International Settlements, and various Swiss banks and the Vatican Bank. And this is one of the relationships that dominates Unholy Trinity. I wonder if you could encapsulate that for us, given
sure.
The fact this is a
the
huge subject.
The Dulles brothers were partners at the law firm Sullivan and Cromwell, and this was the ultimate law firm for the robber barons. This was a firm whose conduct was so reprehensible that it forced the American Bar Association to adopt a canon of ethics to rein in the misdeeds and malpractices of the Sullivan Cromwell law firm. What they did was try and find ways to disguise or cloak American and later British investment in Germany, so that no matter which side won World War II, the investors would get all their money back. So they would have, for example, banks in neutral Amsterdam. They'd have a bank in New York and a bank in Germany. And whichever side won the next war, they would shift the paperwork around and claim that the neutral country owned all the stock. It was a very clever scheme. In fact, George Bush, President Bush's grandfather and great-grandfather were among the founders of this scheme. They were the clients of the Dulles brothers. They had one of the banks in New York. Union Banking Corporation was one of the fronts for moving the money around. Now, you know, in 1918 through 1929, this wasn't so bad. When the Great Depression hit in 1929, it was a scandal that these guys were taking money out of America to buy up German stock. But what really became bad was after Hitler came to power, because these same banks were used to launder money to the infant Nazi party. Some people say that some 70% of all the money that went to rebuild the Third Reich came from American and British investors, and to a lesser extent, the Vatican investors, as we saw. You know, from La Popessa was an eyewitness to the Pope handing bags of cash to Hitler. This was the trend of the times. None of them ever thought that they would be funding the Holocaust or making the Nazi Party an instrument of war. It was all being done for good economic purposes, that fascism was a very efficient corporate model for a state. In fact, its early polite name was corporatism, not fascism.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we should mention that that man was eventually became pope, but at the time he was not pope. He was the papal nuncio to Munich. Now, this relationship continued on up into World War II and then afterward. I wonder, John, before we get to some of the actual moving of persons through the rat lines, some of the relationship between, again, people, their institutions like Sullivan and Cromwell with Alan Dulles and the Bank for International Settlements, the Swiss Bank and the Vatican Bank, and how they moved money during the latter part of the war, and how they had continued to basically traffic in Nazi monies after the war with an enormous flight capital that overlaps the Vatican Bank and some of the things that you talk about and address in the lawsuit.
Sure. Hitler knew that the Vatican and the American investors really didn't like him. They preferred other parties, the German monarchists, for example. So Hitler had to get control, particularly of the Vatican Bank, because the Vatican Bank was the only bank in the world whose couriers had diplomatic immunity. They could move stocks and bonds and cash in diplomatic pouches, and no one would ever be the wiser. What Hitler did was they seized all the Vatican's assets in Germany, which, quite frankly, were very substantial, because after the Lateran Treaty, on Pacelli's advice as the nuncio of Germany, the Vatican stupidly put all of its eggs in one basket, and Hitler was sitting atop the basket. Now, Hitler said to the Catholic Church, if they kept their mouths shut and stayed in line, he would dribble the money back to the church in dribs and drabs. Now, to accept the dribble, the Vatican created what's called the Vatican Bank, the Institute for Religious Works, the IOR, or its initials in Italian. The Vatican Bank was established to receive the funds that Hitler had absconded with. And so throughout World War II, the church was silent. And it was silent in substantial part, I believe, because it was either that or complete bankruptcy. They'd never get their money back unless they played ball with Hitler.
Now, ultimately, as the war began to wind down, the Vatican Bank and Sullivan and Cromwell and the Bank for International Settlements began to get a lot of this Nazi money out of Europe. Could you tell us how the Vatican Bank figured into that relationship with, again, Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Law Firm, BIS, and also an institution that we have not addressed on the air before, something called the World Commerce Corporation? That's something that most people have never heard about, and yet it's a very, very significant element in the latter part of the history of the 20th century.
The Dulles brothers knew that after every war, some of their clients had lost money because the Trading with the Enemy Act would be enforced, and that literally investment money in Germany would be seized for war reparations to pay the cost of a wrongful war. And with the Nazis, the Dulles brothers knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that any money that was invested in Germany would be gone unless it was carefully hidden. So one of the ways they had to hide it was the Bank of International Settlements in Sweden, in Switzerland, that kept the money moving during the war. It was probably essential to the German war machine. Very few people realize that some 30 to 40% of all the imports of war material to Nazi Germany during World War II came through Switzerland. That's how in bed they were with the Third Reich. Switzerland was by no means a neutral nation. Switzerland was heart and soul in bed with the Third Reich. It had a veneer of neutrality, but that was only to keep the Allies from raiding them and looking at their bank records. Now, at the end of the war, the problem was the Allies had broken all the Swiss banking codes. They had them under surveillance. The wealth of the Third Reich, which included what little wealth of the Vatican remained in Hitler's hands, all of that had to be moved out secretly. Well, what they did was move it out through the Vatican Bank. They established, for example, in the case of the ThyssenKrupp Corporation, they went to the bombed-out Thyssen Bank in Berlin, dug up the vaults, took the ownership papers, trucked them back to Amsterdam, and said, oh, look, these factories in Germany really belong to a neutral country, so don't give them to the Russians. The Russians were supposed to divide the war reparations with the Allies, and that quickly collapsed. But there was an American attempt to keep the war operations issue going for several years after World War II. They were trying in good faith to get money taken away from Nazi war profiteers and given to the victims of the Third Reich, particularly to the Jews. That did not go well with the Vatican. For example, there were five major insurance companies in Europe, and two of them were headquartered in Italy. The two in Italy were predominantly owned or controlled by Jewish investors before World War II. These properties were seized. At the end of the war, for some reason, all the Jewish investors were gone, and a series of front companies existed. And, of course, the front companies were controlled in part by the Vatican. That this was the transferring the stock to the insurance companies was one of the ways the Vatican was repaid for helping the Dulles brothers smuggle their clients' money out of Nazi Germany and to escape the war reparations issue. So the Dulles brothers were very, very bad guys. They were Hitler's henchmen before, during, and after the war. And the Vatican, I'm afraid, cooperated. And I hope people understand the Vatican is not the Catholic Church. This is a small right-wing group of Roman clergy, ultra-fascists themselves. They hated democracy. They hated America.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was absolutely despicable.
Yeah, I think we might want to stress that point, because a lot of times, this, when we're talking about a subject like this, people tend to get very emotional, and it's very easy to be accused of being an anti-Catholic bigot or whatever.
Yeah, I'm Roman Catholic, and I think that people have to understand that what happened here had nothing to do with the Catholic Church. This was a group of Italian crooks. It's as if the mafia had hijacked the Italian church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened, because it was the headquarters of the world headquarters of the Roman Catholic Church. It had a phenomenal impact on wartime policy and on post-war money laundering.
One could perhaps, you know, in a general sense, conceptual sense, think of the Vatican as relationship to the Catholic Church, rather like the White House's relationship to the United States. The White House is not necessarily the United States by any means.
Exactly.
And so we want to sidestep that. John, you know, all along I thought you were an agent of the International Jewish Conspiracy.
No.
Oh, gosh.
I'm on the board of Muslim organizations. I was president of the Florida Holocaust Museum. I'm just trying to be... even-handed. I figure that God speaks with one voice, but human beings have different ears to hear him.
Yeah, you mean,
if we listen for the similarities among our religions, then I think we more clearly hear the voice of God.
So you're not a member of the Elders of Zion, huh?
No, sir.
I hear this kind of, I'm sure you've probably heard X amount of that kind of BS being kicked around, he is one of the tools, yeah? But anyway.
Well, I get that too now. I'm being called a Muslim lover, so go figure.
Yeah. You mean you're not an anti-Muslim bigot, because I hear that one too. You know, it just...
Yeah.
It's a strange and complex world, and when one begins to unravel some of these complexities, it gets really strange indeed.
Exactly, but you know, David, it's 90% stupidity, 10% conspiracy. There aren't any great, ideological conspiracies. Most of the time, to me, it seems to be just stupid greed that people were willing to use the institutions of government, of religion, of financial institutions, just to make money.
Yep.
And a lot of the ways they could make money was stealing it.
Well, it's that. And something else that I think really, obviously there's a bit of a personal editorialization, but something else that really helps to further the process, stupidity and greed are a lot of it, but institutional inertia and professionalism, once somebody's signed on with an institution, whether it's, the Central Intelligence Agency or the Justice Department or a corporation or the FBI or whatever, once you've got a career going, one of these things, then you come across wrongdoing on the part of a relatively small number of very powerful people within that institution, then you've got a choice. Do you throw your career down the drain, or do you become a whistleblower and risk sacrificing, your mortgage, your kids' college education, and so forth?
I was stupid enough to be a whistleblower, so...
And here you are, part of the international Jewish / Muslim / conspiracy / anyway, back to the subject of moving the monies after World War II and actually during World War II itself. One of the things that's interesting, and this will serve as a bridge to some of the discussion on part two of the program, and that is how many of the individuals who wore the hats of international money movers, lawyers, and financiers were also spies. Alan Dulles, people like
Jesus Angleton, sure, his assistant, yeah.
And in the World Commerce Corporation, we're looking at people like Sir William Stevenson.
And Bill Donovan, the famous.
And William Donovan.
What happened is the Vatican would move the money to Argentina, and the World Commerce Corporation's job was to repatriate the money from Latin America and move it back to Germany. So the World Commerce Corporation was a front to revive South American German trade after World War II, but in actuality, it was another part of the money laundering operation.
Now, again, Sir William Stevenson, William Donovan, very important people, but names not known to most. These were two of the principals in the World Commerce Corporation.
Yeah.
Detail their role as spies for us, if you would, or at least encapsulate.
Donovan was the head and founder of American Intelligence. He was the first leader of the Office of Strategic Services, the famous World War II spy organization. And Sir William Stevenson was, to a large extent, his British counterpart. And the two worked together on a number of projects. Stevenson was pretty much the British liaison to the U.S. for covert operations at various times. And he and Donovan were quite close. And Donovan, of course, also was very close with the Dulles brothers and was very much involved with the repatriating the Nazi money. The goal was to keep it out of the hands of the communists. Well, it didn't mean that the Nazis had to get it, did it? I mean, couldn't they have just distributed it to the impoverished people of Europe? But sad to say, some very important figures in American history had blood all over their hands, and the blood came from Nazi gold.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Alan Dulles was head of the Bern, Switzerland office of William Donovan's OSS. And the World Commerce Corporation was working with the Vatican Bank in getting Nazi money out of Europe into Argentina, was it not?
Sure, and even after the war, the guy in charge of intelligence investigations in post-war Germany was Alan Dulles. He was investigating himself. It was comic opera stuff.
Mm-hmm. And, again, a lot of this money was on its way to Latin America. John, for last, I'm going to see if I – we'll see how we're doing time-wise here. But on page 300, before we get into some of the intelligence connections and what were known as the rat lines, there's something very eloquent. If there are X number of people. I sometimes get criticized by saying, well, you know, you're talking about stuff that's so long ago. Who cares? It doesn't matter anymore. On page 300 of the paperback edition of Unholy Trinity that you co-authored with Mark Ahrens, you write, laundered through the untraceable, unquote, Vatican Bank, the Nazi treasure moved from Switzerland to South America. There, the stolen funds were invested in a number of Argentine businesses whose lawyer was, of course, Alan Dulles. As the final act of money laundering, Dulles created the World Commerce Corporation to revive trade between Argentina and West Germany. On its board were such notables as William Donovan of U.S. intelligence and William Stevenson of British intelligence. During the 1950s, much of the stolen proceeds were laundered back to Germany for the great economic revival of West Germany. In the end, the money went back to the original German companies and their Western investors. It is not Swiss bank accounts that we should be tracing. It is the stock ownership of the Swiss banks. There lies the last and perhaps ugliest secret of World War II. And therein lies the major culpability of the Vatican and its relations with Hitler's Germany. Without the Vatican's investments in the Third Reich, there could not have been the motive to provide the means to smuggle the Nazis' plundered loot from Switzerland through the Vatican Bank. So in terms of underlying the macroeconomic and broader historical implications of this, I think you summed it up very, very nicely in the end of the book. We're going to talk about a lot of this stuff inside, too, and in particular the rat lines and who some of these people were. But, John, before we get into that, briefly, tell us again your websites that people can talk about Intelligence Summit.
It's www.intelligencesummit.org, and we hope people will come and attend. I hope you come by, too. I think it's an important place for you to meet people that you should know.
Yeah, let's see if I'll have to get to the East Coast. Is any of that going to be taking place on the West Coast?
No, sorry. We're going to do this in Washington, D.C., at the Hyatt Regency Crystal City, right next to the airport, and that'll be February 17th through the 20th, President's Day weekend.
All right, let me see if I can get some time off, and maybe some listeners can kick in the money to buy me the airfare, so we'll see what we can do. This concludes Side 1 of our interview with John Loftus about Intelligence Summit and Unholy Trinity. This has been recorded on November 6th of the year 2005. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.